This is Pete Seeger. When Richard Nixon abused power, Congress held a bipartisan investigation that resulted in articles of impeachment. Evidence now shows that George Bush and Dick Cheney launched an illegal war, lied to Congress, spied on Americans without court approval, leaked classified information, produced phony news reports, imprisoned without charge and tortured, used illegal weapons and targeted civilians. Ask your Congress member to co-sponsor House Resolution 635.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm Cindy Sheehan. This is our special video edition as well as our radio edition. I'm here with my friend Larry Holmes from Bail Out the People organization at bailoutpeople.org. Larry, we're here in Pittsburgh. We're here at this wonderful tent city that you've set up. You've had homeless people here. You've had young people here. You've had all demographics here. Tell us what you're doing here and why this is so important.
Well, we're here because the G20's here. These are the most powerful countries, especially seven or eight of them. The most powerful bankers, finance ministers, and they want to say that the economy is in a recovery when unemployment is still going up. People's homes are being foreclosed on. There's more homelessness, more hunger. And generally, not only the people here in Pittsburgh, the U.S., but all around the world are getting poorer. And so we don't want them to be able to pat themselves on the back and say they saved the world from the Great Depression, when in fact they may have saved Wall Street for a while, but for a lot of people, it is like the Great Depression. If we're not here, I think that that reality would be invisible and silent. And so we've got this tent city in this wonderful, historic African-American community that's called the Hill District, that's very close to downtown where the summit is going to be. And we've had hundreds of people up here. We had a jobs march on Sunday, and we'll be here through today and through tomorrow. And maybe it's not 10,000 people or 100,000 people, but it's enough to make the point. And we're also so happy that you could join us, Cindy, because the anti-war movement, as a component of the social justice movement, is very important. And you represent that more than anyone I could think of. And so it's kind of important to us that you're here with us today. I know you're going to be running around. I would just say, be careful.
Well, definitely. You were just talking earlier. Every time I turn on the news, I hear that the recession is over. Bernanke has said that the recession is over. But they dumped between $12 and $18 trillion into the banks and into Wall Street. So just because Wall Street's doing well, as you pointed out, doesn't mean that we are doing well. We just talked to a sister from Detroit who's losing her home, and she has her utility shut off. So what does bailoutthepeople.org do, or bailoutpeople.org do for people like Catherine? Is it just mainly education? Is it because our nation does need to be educated? We don't need to turn on the TV and see that everything's fine when people are just like, huh, what's wrong with me? If the recession's over, how come I don't have a job? How come I'm losing my home?
No, I'm glad you asked that. Probably our primary demand, our primary issue, I mean, we're touching on all the issues, but the big one is the need for a serious jobs program. There is depression-level unemployment in the United States. Forget about the official statistics. Talk to the people. They'll tell you the truth. And we need a program that is at least as aggressive and as ambitious in scope as the Public Works program that was established by the Roosevelt administration during the Depression of the 1930s, where 8 million workers got jobs. And they weren't the best jobs as far as wages, but they were paid comparable wages based on the industry that they were working in. And we should also add that Roosevelt did not create the public works jobs out of the goodness of his heart. It's because unemployed people and poor people were marching on Washington, marching in New York, marching in the Midwest. People were demonstrating and rioting. And so he had to do it if he wanted to hold on, frankly, to the country. We need to do that now. What we're doing here in Pittsburgh is a very small part of trying to open that up. I should also add that I don't think that we can have that jobs movement or a movement to stop foreclosures of homes or a movement to assure that we have a single-payer health care unless the labor movement stops getting so cozy with the Democratic Party and feels that they can sort of sort out everything behind closed doors because they have such a wonderful relationship either with the White House or with Congress, and call their members out. Flex your muscles, for goodness sake. You know, you look at health care and you look at this ridiculous scene at these town meetings where the right wing is mobilized and so racist and carrying signs portraying Obama as a monkey. That stuff is dangerous. And I think to myself, and I know you got to think this too, Cindy. I know a lot of people think this. If the labor unions wanted to, they could bring a million people to Washington to demand single-payer health care. They've got the money to do it. The problem is they give it to the Democrats. And so I would say that our march and our tent city is also, in its own way, a reminder to labor leaders, do something, not that, something different. And it's working a little bit. Leo Girard, the president of the United Steelworkers, came by yesterday, and he gave us some support, both material. And then he went next door to that church, Monumental Baptist Church, and he gave a speech, and he called for a movement for jobs. Now, I don't know whether that was rhetoric. I don't know whether he's serious. But, hey, sounds like something is working.
Well, a jobless recovery is not a recovery. And like you said, at best it's temporary, and then the house of cards are just going to fall down. So you think it would be in the best interest of the labor movement for single payer and for a job full recovery. Now let's go to the things that have been happening here this week. I was just standing there and the fire department brought you all some food. I think that I understand that's been something that has been pretty common this week here at Tent City, people bringing food and water supplies and things like that.
No, that's just tremendous. I've seen a lot, Cindy, but I've never seen anything like that. You know, the fire department is usually so close to the police that they usually share their attitudes about things. So for three or four fire workers to come over and give us some of their military meals is just incredible. But in addition to that, people have been driving by and leaving bottles of water, leaving napkins, leaving soap and toiletries.
I was going to say, toilet paper is really important.
Toilet paper, leaving toys and books for the children that we have. And, you know, this is a very repressed community. It's suffering gentrification. You can see most of the stores are boarded up. Most of the buildings are boarded up. So, you know, there was a concern amongst the residents when we initially announced our plans that we've got enough problems. What other problems are you going to bring to us by having this tent city for the unemployed? But we've won them over, and now they support us. And I'll tell you, of all the things that we've accomplished, all the small things, I think that's the thing that I feel most proud about.
Larry, you guys do good work. We have a little action we're planning in D.C. beginning in January, so we hope bailout people can be involved with it. It's a little bit of a secret. We'll let you in on it, my listeners and my viewers, and we'll talk about it, and we hope that you guys can be involved because these issues are not separate.
You can depend on us.
You know, and Martin Luther King Jr. said that the triple evils are racism, poverty, and militarism. So, and if we want any help or anything good happening for us, we have to end all those three.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's give a piece to my revolution piece. Yay. Thank you, Larry.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm Cindy Sheehan. We're at CindySheehanSoapbox.com and Rational Radio 1360 AM. That was my interview with Larry Holmes here in Pittsburgh, the United Police States of America. Coming up is an interview that Cynthia McKinney did for me with Howard Zinn. Cynthia had to fill in with me because I was here protesting the G20.
Cindy Sheehan's new booklet, Myth America, examines two distinct groups of people that clearly show that we are not all in this together, as President Obama declared. The first group, the robber class, are wealthy victimizers such as those corporations and politicians that profit off the hard labor of others through economic theft and violent exploitation. The second group, the robbed class, are the victims, such as those who work multiple jobs just to make ends meet, those who send their children off to die in robber class wars, those who lack proper health care, those who are denied decent education, and those who lose their jobs and homes and become homeless. Myth America exposes America's robber class, which controls our government, and affirms that we, the robbed class, can only be robbed if we allow it. To obtain a copy of Myth America and learn how we can take back our country, please visit CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you are listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.CindySheehansSoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Hi, this is Cynthia McKinney, and I am trying to do the impossible, and that is to sit in for Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox on Rational Radio in Dallas. And one can also tune in on the internet at CindySheehansSoapbox.com. My special guest today is Howard Zinn, who is the most famous author and historian and writer of the landmark, the People's History of the United States. And he is also celebrating, along with all of us, the fact that that book and the second book, Voices of a People's History, is now been turned into a documentary entitled The People Speak. And featured in this documentary are musical performances by Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, John Legend, and it goes on and on and on. So it is a distinct pleasure for me to have on the other end of this phone the noted historian Howard Zinn. Welcome.
Oh, thank you, Cynthia. I have admired you for years, but I don't think I've ever had a chance to talk with you.
I know. So we have to.
This is the most intimate conversation we have ever had. This is as close as we can get, I suppose, several thousand miles. But anyway, it's a pleasure to talk with you, Cynthia. And
I have to say thank you to Cindy Sheehan for giving me the opportunity to sit in for her at this particular moment when you were the scheduled guest, because you're absolutely right. We have not had the opportunity to even be in the same room together, to be on the same telephone line together, and now here we are. And Cindy is off doing what Cindy does best, and that's why I'm sitting in for her, because she is in Pittsburgh. She is demonstrating, standing up for the little people, standing up for all of us, doing what she does best. And so I'm happy to have this opportunity to be with you today.
Cindy has been an inspiration for all of us. Her voice and her presence made itself felt really just when it was needed, when George Bush and his gang were trying to create a unanimity in the American public and trying to silence everybody who dissented by saying, well, you're either for us or against us, and the implication being, well, you know, if you're against us, you are somehow connected with terrorism and Al-Qaeda. I mean, and so in that intimidating atmosphere, Cindy Sheehan spoke out, and I think she then provoked other people to speak out. So that was a very important thing that she did.
She is definitely a role model for all of us. I know she is my personal shero. I look up to her. And anytime I have the opportunity to be with her, I take advantage of that opportunity because I love that she showed us the power of the individual. One woman made a difference. She took a stand, and she showed all of us that we can do the same. And so now that fits right in with you, and what you provide to all of us is how it is that ordinary folks can spark movements and make a difference. So in this environment of the Obama administration, and people were swept up in the moment of the possibility that was presented by Barack Obama, and this idea, these notions of hope and change, and coming after 8 years of George W. Bush, the one thing that the global community needed and the American people wanted was hope and change. And we've come up a little short now. Can you explain to us what exactly is going on and why it's happening and what it is that average, ordinary people can do to catalyze change?
Well, you put your finger on it, Cynthia. I mean, you're asking a lot of me, but of course, I refuse to be daunted. What I remember about you is that you were undaunted. See, the first I heard of you, I'm going a little off your question, but this is, you know, I believe in long prefaces to answers. So this is a little preface to my answer. But I took note of you, Cynthia, and it's connected with Cindy Sheehan and what she did. Because the first note I took of you was that in the immediate days following the first war against Iraq by the senior Bush, when that war began, there was just as after 9/11, there was an overwhelming silence, and people were intimidated. You spoke out. You were a lone voice speaking out against that war, and I took note of that. And you know, you spoke just a minute ago about the necessity for, you know, ordinary people to get together, but very often people are reluctant to speak out until somebody does it first. And so always we've had, whenever social movements have developed in the United States, even though these movements have been movements of large numbers of people, very often the movements are sparked by some one act, some one person taking the first step. You know, it's like those four kids in Greensboro, North Carolina, in February 1960, you know, sitting in. And when they did it, soon it was done all over the South. So we will need that today. We will need people speaking out today because, and this goes to your question about the Obama administration and what has happened since that euphoria, that glow of enthusiasm that followed his election, Since that has begun to wear off, what is our situation today? And you're right. There was a moment of exaltation, and I felt it too. And how could you not feel it to see an African American man, a man of intelligence and articulate and graceful, and to see him enter the presidency, a historic moment, and to sweep aside, you know, we hoped those 8 years of horror under the Bush administration. So yes, I felt that euphoria too. And I remember watching on television, and I was especially moved on election night when I saw on television, I saw the pictures of students at Spelman College in Atlanta. And, you know, I had taught at Spelman College for 7 years in the late 50s and early 60s and participated with my students in the movement. And it was thrilling for me to see Spelman College students and to see how happy they were that Obama now was president of the United States. So, yes, it was justified. That enthusiasm was justified. However, since he took office, Obama has not, and this is what you suggested in your question, Cynthia, Obama has not fulfilled the promise of change and hope that he presented so eloquently during the campaign. And what has happened? Well, you know, he has followed in the traditional Democratic Party history. What is the history of the Democratic Party? The history of the Democratic Party is, in foreign policy, very close to the history of the Republican Party. Hmm. By that I mean that Democratic presidents, however they might be a little more liberal and open in domestic policy, however they might be more open on labor issues, race issues, a little more than the Republicans, however they might differ from the Republicans on those issues, on foreign policy, historically, Democrats have been as warlike as Republicans. Democratic presidents have gotten us into war, well, even you might say more often than Republicans. You know, I mean, starting with Democrat Woodrow Wilson in the First World War. And then in our time, Truman in Korea and Kennedy and Johnson in Vietnam. So there is, yes, this Democratic Party history of militarism and war and aggression. And we all had perhaps a hope from the way Obama was talking about change that perhaps he would move away from that history, that perhaps he would break new ground, that perhaps Obama would say, we obviously have failed with military methods, with going to war in Iraq, with going to war in Afghanistan. We have to find a new way of being a power in the world, but not a military power or humanitarian power. That's what we were hoping for when Obama became president. But as we know, and it's quite clear, it's not even hate.
So, in your estimation, the people voted for peace.
Yes, I think so. People did vote for peace. And, you know, and in general, people's natural inclinations are for peace. They can be diverted from that. They can be made to support war by a very intense propaganda campaign, which is what happens whenever any administration decides on war, they embark on a very powerful campaign to persuade people that the war is necessary. But that goes against people's natural instincts, which I believe are for peace. And Obama appeals to those instincts, and now he is going against that. So I think we are going to need in this country a new social movement which stands for peace and which reminds Obama in the most forceful way possible and reminds Congress that we voted for Obama on the supposition that would be change. We wanted a move away from the violence of the Bush administration, and we are not getting that.
So can you tell us where the Obama flashpoints are? Of course, we know about AFPAC. Pakistan doesn't exist anymore. Afghanistan doesn't exist anymore. It's AFPAC these days. We know about Iraq, but the world is a big place. Where are these other Obama flashpoints where the United States is contributing not to the peace?
Yeah, well, yeah, it's sad to see, you know, that the Obama administration, first of all, immediately began to follow through on his campaign promise to send more troops to Afghanistan. Immediately began to move that into place. And then at the same time, he began to attack Pakistan. And within days after he had taken office, these guided missiles, these Predator missiles, were flying over Afghanistan and killing innocent people. And this has been going on. Pakistanis have been dying under our bombs. We're not even supposed to be at war with Pakistan, right? But so the Obama administration has taken over the military stance, well, not just of Bush, but of all previous administrations. You know, ever since World War II, you know, we have become a militarized country, a country which is in virtual perpetual warfare, and Obama has taken that over and become part of it. And you know, I was just thinking about the military budget and the hope that, well, it's this enormous, swollen, ridiculous military budget of $600-odd billion under the Bush administration. And surely Obama is not going to be willing to spend such an enormous amount of our national treasury on war. But in fact, he has. In fact, he's increased the military budget. So what does that mean? It means we, and especially people who supported Obama, people who were his constituency, people who voted for him and worked for him and yes, elected him, these people now have to take that energy that they used to elect Obama, and now they have to use that energy to speak very forcefully to Obama and to tell him that we want a peaceful world, and we want the United States to lead the way towards a peaceful world.
What about Iraq?
There's Iraq, and Obama talked about withdrawal from Iraq, and there were people who believed him. You know, he sounded very sincere. Well, sure, he had a timetable. He wasn't going to withdraw immediately. What they use the term precipitously. They always say, we mustn't withdraw precipitously. I always really find that amusing, because after you've been occupying a country, you know, for 6 or 7 years, the very idea that if you withdraw, that would be precipitous is kind of amusing. There's nothing precipitous about withdrawing after you've been somewhere 6 years. By the way, they used to use the same term with Vietnam. After we'd been in Vietnam for years, they said, well, you mustn't withdraw precipitously. Well, so Obama was not going to withdraw precipitously. He was going to withdraw, well, by a timetable. Well, that timetable isn't even talked about now. There's no sense that we are going to withdraw from Iraq. I mean, they talk about, 2010, 2011, 2012. But even when Obama talks about withdrawing troops from Iraq, he talks about maintaining a certain number of troops in Iraq. And also, he does not talk about all those forces in Iraq which are private security forces. Well, security, the word security is misused because they're not contributing to the security of anybody. But these are the private contractors who are a private army in Iraq, who have committed atrocities in Iraq, who are draining the wealth of Iraq. You know, the Blackwater and all of those corporations which are profiting enormously from Iraq. And their emissaries, tens of thousands of them in Iraq, they apparently are going to remain, even if Obama withdraws troops. And he doesn't talk about dismantling our bases. We have dozens and dozens and dozens of military bases all over Iraq, and we have the largest embassy in the world, an obscenely large embassy. Now, there's no talk about dismantling all of that and leaving Iraq alone and letting the people there decide their own fate. So it's Obama's position on Iraq is something that really people should pay attention to, and people should point out to him that he is violating the promises that he made.
Well, does Obama have his first coup under his belt in Honduras? What's going on there?
I wish I knew what was going on in Honduras, but unfortunately it's a continuation of American policy in Latin America, in Central America. The United States, has been the military and economic dominant force in Central America for a long time. And, starting with the beginning of the 20th century, starting with the conquest of Cuba. I call it the conquest of Cuba. It was supposed to be the liberation of Cuba from Spain in 1898, but it was really the conquest of Cuba by the United States. And then the United States takes Puerto Rico. And in the following years, the United States Marines move into the various countries in Central America, Honduras and Nicaragua and Guatemala, and establish American economic corporate dominance in these countries. And so Obama seems to be continuing along the same path of the U.S. being the big brother. It's shameful what we have done to these countries in the Caribbean. I mean, I think of Haiti, which when it declared its independence at the beginning of the 19th century, was a country rich with resources. Now it's the poorest country in Latin America, one of the poorest countries in the world, and the United States is supporting that poverty in Haiti by sanctions against Haiti and starving Haiti, really the same thing that it's trying to do to Cuba. The difference being that Cuba has sort of a government which is resisting the United States, and people who are united in resisting the United States. But the Obama administration is unfortunately not showing any change in its policy towards the Caribbean and Latin America.
This is Cynthia McKinney, and you're listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox on Rational Radio in Dallas. And you can join us on the internet at CindySheehansSoapbox.com. Today we're talking with the famous, noted historian and author, Howard Zinn, and we were discussing a little bit about Obama's foreign policy. We left off with a discussion of Haiti, and what's going on there is particularly interesting.
as I read also that the United States is building a huge embassy there and has taken one of the islands off the coast of Haiti, and Haitians are not even allowed to go there. In addition, what I just recently learned was that DynCorp is setting up shop in Haiti. Now, the last thing that I knew about DynCorp when I was in the Congress was that they had been accused by their own employees of trafficking in women and little girls. So why is it, Howard, that these companies, these corporations like Blackwater and DynCorp, why do they have immunity?
Well, they have immunity because the American government has always been very closely tied to corporate power. And, you know, very often we grow up in this country thinking, well, you know, the government is sort of neutral. They're the rich and they're the poor, they're the corporations and they're working people. And then there's the government, which is sort of outside of that and overseeing all of that. But that's a very false picture. The government and corporate America, the government and big business, have always been very closely tied together. You might say in alliance against the people of the country. And this is not something new. This is something that goes way back. And I want to emphasize that what we are seeing in the Obama administration, you know, is not something new. What we saw in the Bush administration was not something new. I mean, Bush carried ugly things to their extreme, but the fundamental fact of corporate power in the American government and corporate influence in the American government and the American government doing what big business needs, that goes back to the beginning of the Republic. That goes back to the founding fathers. And a lot of people don't recognize this because our history books give us very glowing and idealistic pictures of the founding fathers and how wonderful it was that they won independence from England, and then they created a constitution with a new government and a strong central government. But that is a very distorted story, because what the founding fathers did when they created a constitution, they created a constitution that was deliberately designed to serve the interests of the economic elite. It was a constitution that created a government that would be strong enough to put down the rebellions of working people, of farmers, of black people, of Indians, because, and here is something, and I hope you don't mind, Cynthia, am I going off into ancient history?
No. This is a great benefit to all of us.
It's not that ancient, you know, when you think of it. We're a relatively new country. But when the founding fathers gathered in Philadelphia in 1787, they were very sensitive, very conscious of the fact that just the year before, there had been rebellions of farmers in western Massachusetts and in other parts of the country, in other states, because after the Revolution, when veterans were given little pieces of land to compensate them for their military service, then their land was taxed so heavily they couldn't pay the taxes, and therefore their farms and livestock and houses were being taken away from them. They rebelled by the thousands, and they scared the elites who were really the new leaders of the independent government. And so the idea in getting together in Philadelphia is to create a government strong enough to deal with such rebellions. And they were very explicit about it. And they did that. They created a government which would serve the interests of the slave owners, the bondholders, the merchants, the Western expansionists, that set the example for the rest of American history. In other words, the alliance between the government and the economic elite in the country, the government serving them. Yes, the welfare state for the rich started very early, right after the Revolution, with the establishment of the Constitution. So what is going on today, coming back to your point about, you know, Blackwater and these other corporations that are intruding into other countries and really sucking the wealth from them, what is happening today is really continuation of a historic fact about the American political system, and that is the wealthy classes have always dominated our political system. They have orchestrated our foreign policy to suit their needs and their interests, and that is what is going on.
But, you know, I'm gonna get depressed in a minute, because I thought it was possible for us to really make policy. I thought that it was possible for the people to make the policy reflective of the interests of the people. And that's what has energized me and animated me and really motivated me to get out and do the things that I've done at great sacrifice to myself and my family. And when I hear this perspective, you're absolutely right that this is not new, the battle that we're fighting. So
how can we
win? What's the solution? What can we do?
I hear you, Cynthia, when you say my account of what our situation is depressing. It is, until you consider that there are certain times in American history when people have fought back and changed things. Despite this control of the American government by the economic elite, there have been times when people have organized and protested and resisted and brought about change. Well, we know this was true in the 1930s, when workers formed labor unions, went out on strike. They sat in and they took over the factories at General Motors and Firestone Rubber and so on, and they managed to change their working conditions as a result of a kind of a national upsurge of rebellion against corporate power. So we saw this in the 1930s. Again, in the 1960s, we did see just what you were asking for and wondering about. And as in the 1960s, we saw people gathering together, organizing in the South, black people deciding that the government is not going to end racial segregation. No matter how liberal the presidents are supposed to be, Kennedy, Johnson, they are not going to take the initiative in ending racial segregation in the South. We're going to have to do it ourselves. And so black people in all through the South organized, mobilized. Well, you know that story better probably than I do. They demonstrated and protested and committed civil disobedience and went to prison and were beaten, and some of them were killed, but they changed the South. And not enough, of course, because no change is ever enough, but changed it enough so that we could see the possibility of people power accomplishing something. And then again during the Vietnam War, we saw what seemed to be impossible. Here's the most powerful government on earth carrying on a war half a world away. How are we going to stop it? Well, the resistance grew and grew and grew. And when the government saw that It could not command the support of the American people, could not command the support of its soldiers who were deserting, who were fragging officers, who were refusing to fight out in the field. When the government saw that it was losing the support of the people, well, then it had to bring the war to an end. So we have had instances in American history which suggest to us that this overwhelming pattern of corporate dominance and beating down people and abroad and here, that that can be resisted. The possibility exists. And the reason it exists is that the power of the people in authority, their power rests on the obedience of everybody else. When people stop obeying, their power ends. When workers stop working, corporations are helpless. When soldiers refuse to fight, a war cannot go on. So, yes, there's no need to be depressed by a reality which so far has not changed, but I think has the possibility of changing depending on what we do.
This is a beautiful, beautiful reminder, because you're absolutely right. You know, I grew up in the South during the time of the Civil Rights Movement, and I saw what organized people power could do. And I despair sometimes that I don't see it in evidence as effectively as it was done back then, but I do see it in other parts of the world. We see it in Latin America. We see it even in Honduras with everything. They shut off the electricity in the Brazilian embassy where the duly elected president has sought refuge. But the people haven't given up. The people didn't give up in Venezuela. They didn't give up in Cuba. They didn't give up in Brazil. The people didn't give up. And so as long as we remember that the power rests with us, then I think this idea of us just stop obeying, that's one of the cardinal ways in which we can express our resistance. Just stop obeying. I love that message. Now, the final thing in the final minutes that we have, I thought I would talk about. For some reason, I decided that I wanted to look at Dr. Strangelove. And so just before this conversation, I pulled out my TiVo, and I played that movie. And what I saw there and what I feel now is really interesting, because it seems as if we in this country are tiptoeing around the precipice, that something big and something bad is being orchestrated, and it's big and it's bad for little people like me. And immediately we look at the $7 trillion that this government has borrowed over this past year, the $12 trillion that were committed in these various bailouts. The Federal Reserve is turning out, it's printing the money like crazy. And people are losing their jobs. There's talk about hyperinflation. Can you help us make some sense out of, is the United States going to collapse?
Well, certainly our economic system is falling apart. I mean, this is we used to be a creditor nation, now we're a debtor nation. We used to have surpluses, and now we have deficits. Our people, as you say, people can't afford to pay their mortgages. They can't afford to pay their rent. People are losing their jobs. So I don't know if the word collapse, collapse suggests something very swift and precipitous, but I think we are seeing a gradual and maybe not so gradual decline of the American economic system. It's a system that never worked, even though it has always been hailed. The American economic system has always been hailed as an example of the success of capitalism. Capitalism has never worked. It has worked for the upper classes. It has worked somewhat for the middle classes. It has never worked for 40, 50 million Americans, for the bottom one-third or one-fourth of the population. And so it really has been a failure all along. But in times of crisis, the failure becomes very evident, very apparent. What is it going to take now? It's going to take what it took during the 1930s when people faced economic collapse in the 30s. It'll take people organizing. It'll take homeowners organizing to prevent their homes from being taken away, tenants organizing to prevent evictions, workers organizing to take over factories and take, do what was done in Chicago not long ago, right, where the workers just follow the example of the General Motors sit-iners, and they took over the factory in rebellion against what was being done to them. Yes, we're going to need a new movement of rebellion in this country, and sure, you don't see it now, but I think the potential is there.
Well, thank you so much, Howard. Unfortunately, we've come to the end of our allotted time, and there's so much more that I wanted to cover with you, but maybe we'll leave that for the next time Cindy Sheehan gets arrested. This is Cynthia McKinney, and I'm standing in for Cindy Sheehan on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox with Rational Radio in Dallas. Tune in on the internet at CindySheehansSoapbox.com. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, Howard, for being with us.
A pleasure, Cynthia.
By order of the City of Pittsburgh Chief Police, I hereby declare this to be an unlawful assembly. I order all those assembled to immediately disperse. You must leave the immediate vicinity. If you remain in this immediate vicinity, you will be in violation of the Pennsylvania Crimes Code. No matter what your purpose is, you must leave. If you do not disperse, you may be arrested and or subject to other police action. Other police action may include actual physical removal, the use of riot control agents and or less lethal munitions, which could cause risk of injury to those who remain.